Abraham Verghese follows a long line of doctors who are also gifted writers. His day job is teaching internal medicine at the Stanford Medical School. His night job? Creating fictional worlds that revolve around the complications doctors often face. Verghese's latest book, Cutting for Stone, is set partly in an African mission hospital in the 1950s. It's the story of a brash British surgeon who has an illicit affair with his nurse. The story's narrator, Marion Stone, is the product of that affair, who grows up to be a doctor himself. Steve Paulson asked Verghese to read a passage from the novel.
We come unbidden into this life, and if we are lucky, we find a purpose beyond starvation, misery, and early death, which, lest we forget, is the common lot. I grew up and I found my purpose, and it was to become a physician. My intent wasn't to save the world as much as to heal myself. Few doctors will admit this, certainly not young ones, but subconsciously, in entering the profession, we must believe that ministering to others will heal our woundedness. And it can, but it can also deepen the wound.
Now, the beginning of your story is set in Ethiopia in the 1950s, and much of it takes place in a health clinic there, where there are a group of rather heroic doctors and nurses who were doing their best to try to save lives and in really the most difficult conditions. Why did you choose that particular time and place?
This is a fictional work, so it's really not based on real people, but I did use geography that I knew well. I was born in Ethiopia of expatriate parents and had all my education there, so I knew the land well, and I had actually begun my medical training in a British hospital that was for all of East Africa, and I liked the idea of a mission hospital because there's something very elemental about the nature of the patient-physician interaction. It's not diluted by testing and paperwork and reams of, you know, subsidiary people. And the nature of the suffering is unadulterated. The physician's fiduciary responsibility to the patient becomes really undisguisable.
And the way you write about this health clinic in Ethiopia, I mean, there's minimal technology there, and there's not even a blood bank. I mean, you know, if someone is starting to lose excessive blood, that's a life and death matter.
Indeed it is. And I think we have to recognize that the great majority of primary care facilities in this kind of setting in Africa and parts of Asia do not have operating theaters, do not have blood bank. And so short of transporting the patient to a place where they can be operated on, those kinds of places cannot possibly cope. And if they can't get them to the right place, basically life ends.
Do you think too many American doctors have fallen in love with their equipment so they lose some of that hands-on contact with patients?
I'm not sure that they've fallen in love as much as they've become completely dependent on it. For the longest time, we used this excuse of defensive medicine to say, well, you know, even though I know nothing is going on here, I need to get this test and I need to get that test. But I think what's happened is we've become completely dependent on the technology. And I argue that if you come to my hospital or yours missing a finger, no one is going to believe you unless they get an X-ray and a CAT scan and an orthopedic consult. You know, it's like we've stopped trusting our senses. And the great danger to that is, first of all, we order tests that are expensive, dangerous. And secondly, in a system where you are paid for doing rather than thinking, there's a lot of things you can be doing that generate a lot of money, make healthcare expensive, but do nothing for the patient. My fundamental argument is that one thing that has not changed since antiquity is the nature of the way the patient and physician interact. And a very important part of that is the physician examining the patient. When I examine the patient well, I think I convey something to the patient subconsciously in that skill. It's a ritual, and I think all rituals are about transformation, whether it's the ritual of inaugurating a president or a ritual of marriage. Rituals are about transformation. The ritual of examining a patient well is what makes that physician-patient bond come about. And I think if you shortchange that and put your stethoscope on the pajamas or do this very cursory probing of the belly with an unskilled hand, the patient picks up on that. You've broken the ritual. You have lost some degree of trust with the patient.
And when you're talking about examining a patient well, you're talking about a real hands-on examination. I mean, this is a very tactile process.
You know, it's the exact process that we teach all our medical students in the first and second years, you know, to examine the patient from head to foot and use their reflex hammers and tuning forks and ophthalmoscopes. And they arrive on the wards and they suddenly realize that the only function of the stethoscope seems largely to be a mating symbol to indicate your eligibility for marriage in the hospital elevator or something like that, you know. They see that the pulse of medicine revolves around shipping people for this test and that test. And I think in the hands of a skilled physician who believes in the bedside exam, two things happen. If I'm allowed to examine the patient well and take a good history, I believe that I'm a day and a half ahead of people who have to wait for all the tests to fall out of the sky before they can, you know, decide what to do next. I believe I'm more cost-effective. I will order less unnecessary next steps. And thirdly, I believe I get a better bond with the patient so that particularly if the condition is chronic and what is needed to keep them going and sustain them is a good, strong relationship, I will have built that through the exam. So I'm very much an advocate for that kind of care. And I've been going around the country saying how the patient in the bed anymore has become an icon for the real patient who's in the computer.
Well, one thing you do in your novel is you take us back to a time and a place where there isn't all this technology, and you have a very gripping scene early in the book where your narrator's mother is giving birth, and it's a very difficult birth. It turns out that she has twins who are joined at the head, and the surgeon in the room, Dr. Stone, is the father of these boys. Could you read a passage from that scene?
Sure, I'd love to. Thomas Stone cocked his head from side to side, trying to match Monroe Kerr's illustration of instruments, the Smillie scissors, the bronze cranioclast, the Jardine cephalotribe, with the objects he juggled in his hand. His tools were distant cousins of the ones depicted in the book, but clearly designed for the same sinister purpose. With two Jacob's clamps, he grabbed the oval of my brother's scalp. Then, using scissors, he cut the skin between the two clamps and gave the intruder its first introduction to pain. His next move was to try to put the cephalotribe, the skull crusher, on the head. This awkward medieval instrument had three separate pieces. The middle was a spear meant to go deep into the brain, cutting a big opening in the skull as it did so. Flanking it were two forceps-like structures to clamp to the outside of the skull. Once all three pieces were in place, Stone would be able to crush and grip the skull so it wouldn't slide away. Out would come the intruder. It was cool in the operating theater, but sweat from his brow trickled into his eye and went into the mask. He tried to drive the spear in. The child, my brother Shiva, sheltered for 8 months and already hurting from the cut of scissors on his scalp, cried out in the womb. Stone decided it would be easier if he first applied the outer two blades of the cephalotribe, then dragged the head within reach, and then inserted the spear. His hands were clumsy in this awkward space. Matron shuddered at the damage he might be doing to Sister Mary Joseph Praise's tissues and to the baby as he jammed each piece past an ear until, finally, he had the skull in his grasp, or thought he did. Matron was close to dropping. It is the duty of the nurse to assist and anticipate the doctor's every need. Wasn't this what she herself preached to the probationers? But it was all wrong, and she didn't know how to begin to turn it around. She was sorry she ever dug out the instruments. A humane obstetrician invented these instruments for mothers with the most desperate needs, not for desperate physicians. A fool with a tool is still a fool. In Stone's hands, the instruments had taken over, and they were doing the thinking for him. Matron knew that nothing good could ever come out of that.
One thing that struck me so powerfully about your book is the vividness of your scenes where surgery is being performed. And I have to say that most of the fiction I've read where there are medical scenes, the actual medical procedures are usually skipped over pretty quickly. But you seem to have made a deliberate choice to do something different, to make surgery a part of your story. Is that something you thought about going into this story?
I think so. You know, I had a choice when I was leaving medical school to become an internist or a surgeon, and I love them both equally, really, and had a great sense that I would be losing something if I chose one over the other. And I think what I missed most about surgery was the wonderful tactile and three-dimensional and visual nature of it. I was hoping in the novel to try and capture some of that excitement. And it's a challenge because in this day and age with, you know, television and the Discovery Channel and so on, there's not a place that we haven't been as viewers with a interest in such matters. And yet, I think there's something about writing and picking the right details that give you the kind of emphasis that allows yet another picture to emerge. So I take it as a compliment if you enjoyed the details.
I did, very much so. So I'm curious, do surgeons tend to have different personalities than other kinds of doctors?
I think they do, and even if they don't, they often adopt, you know, what I think of as a surgical persona. It's unfair to portray them with such a broad brush, but, you know, I think surgeons come in all forms, but they tend to be people who enjoy doing rather than reflecting and thinking and sorting things out. So I think if you're of the cognitive sort of thoughtful bent, you're more inclined to internal medicine, where if you're impatient with that sort of thing and really like the idea of fixing things, then surgery draws you. So, but having said that, I think the best surgeons are some of the ones that I've interacted with and have the greatest respect for, in many ways are operating internists. They are thoughtful, they're deliberate, they are careful, and they are men and women of action. So I think the stereotype is dangerous because it sucks people into it, and it also suggests that there are no exceptions, but there are.
Mm-hmm. The stereotype being that swagger that surgeons tend to carry.
The swagger, yeah. There's the joke that, you know, a doctor dies and goes to heaven, and in the cafeteria line, he's there with St. Peter, and someone in a scrub suit comes brushing past him and jumps the line and gets to the cashier, and the new physician visitor to heaven says, who's that? And he says, oh, that's God. He thinks he's a surgeon. So again, dangerous stereotypes, and right. I don't want to be chastised over it, but there's some element of truth to that. I am not known for speed or daring or technical genius. Call me steady. Call me plodding. Say I adopt the style and technique that suits the patient and the particular situation, and I'll consider that high praise. I take heart from my fellow physicians who come to me when they themselves must suffer the knife. They know that Marion Stone will be as involved after the surgery as before and during. They know I have no use for surgical aphorisms such as, when in doubt, cut it out, or why wait when you can operate, other than for how reliably they reveal the shallowest intellects in our field. My father, for whose skills as a surgeon I have the deepest respect, says, "The operation with the best outcome is the one you decide not to do. Knowing when not to operate, knowing when I am in over my head, knowing when to call for the assistance of a surgeon of my father's caliber, that kind of talent, that kind of brilliance goes unheralded." On one occasion, with a patient in grave peril, I begged my father to operate. He stood silent at the bedside, his fingers lingering on the patient's pulse long after he had registered the heart rate, as if he needed the touch of skin, the thready signal in the radial artery, to catalyze his decision. I imagined I could see the cogs turning in his head. I imagined I saw the shimmer of tears in his eyes. With utmost care, he weighed one option against another. At last, he shook his head and turned away. I followed. "Dr. Stone," I said, using his title, though I longed to cry out, "Father." "An operation is his only chance," I said. In my heart, I knew the chance was infinitesimally small, and the first whiff of anesthesia might end it all. My father put his hand on my shoulder. He spoke to me gently, as if to a junior colleague rather than to his son. "Marion, remember the 11th commandment," he said. "Thou shalt not operate on the day of a patient's death."
Abraham Verghese teaches at the Stanford Medical School. His novel is called Cutting for Stone. He spoke with Steve Paulson.